am prepared to render my decision now based upon the record that's before me. Motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim may be granted only if it is clear that no relief can be granted under any set of facts that could be proven consistent with the allegations. That's Dubois versus Ford Motor Credit Company, 276 F3rd, 1019, 1022, 8th Circuit, 2002. Quoting Abels v. Farmers Commodities Corp., 259 F3rd, 910, 916, 8th Circuit, 2001. I must therefore determine whether, in light of the state court's summary judgment decision and the express language of counts 3 and 4 of Byers' state court counterclaim, I can grant debtors any relief based on their adversary complaint. The short answer is no, I cannot. The much longer answer requires careful consideration of each of the bases for Byers' motion to dismiss. Debtors correctly argue that the Rooker-Feldman doctrine does not apply to the facts of this adversary proceeding. In ExxonMobil Corp. v. Saudi Basic Industries, 544 U.S. 280, that's a Supreme Court decision from 2005, the Supreme Court explained, quote, "The Rooker-Feldman doctrine we hold today is confined to cases of the kind from which the doctrine acquired its name, cases brought by state court losers complaining of injuries caused by state court judgments rendered before the district court proceedings commence and inviting district court review and rejection of those judgments. Rooker-Feldman does not otherwise override or supplant preclusion doctrine or augment the circumscribed doctrines that allow federal courts to stay or dismiss proceedings in deference to state court actions." That's Exxon at 284 to 85. The Supreme Court went on to say, "When there is parallel state and federal litigation, Rooker-Feldman is not triggered simply by the entry of judgment in state court. This court has repeatedly held that the pendency of an action in the state court is no bar to proceedings concerning the same matter in the federal court having jurisdiction. Comity or abstention doctrines may, in various circumstances, permit or require the federal court to stay or dismiss the federal action in favor of the state court litigation. But neither Rooker nor Feldman supports the notion that properly invoked concurrent jurisdiction vanishes if a state court reaches judgment on the same or related question while the case remains sub judice in a federal court. Disposition of the federal action, once the state court adjudication is complete, would be governed by preclusion law. The Full Faith and Credit Act requires the federal court to give the same preclusive effect to a state court judgment as another court of that state would give. Preclusion, of course, is not a jurisdictional matter. In parallel litigation, a federal court may be bound to recognize the claim and issue preclusive effects of a state court judgment, but federal jurisdiction over an action does not terminate automatically on the entry of judgment in the state court." That's Exxon at 292 to 93. Paraphrasing the Supreme Court, the pendency of the state court action in this case is no bar to this adversary proceeding. Res judicata, or claim preclusion, does not apply to the facts of this adversary proceeding either. In Moe v. Moe, 496 Northwest 2nd, 593, South Dakota, 1993, the South Dakota Supreme Court explained, "Res judicata embodies a concept of merger and bar and is therefore broader than issue preclusion or collateral estoppel. One of the purposes of res judicata is to protect parties from being subjected twice to the same cause of action, since public policy is best served when litigation has a finality. We stated in Rashke v. DeGraff that if the prior final judgment or order had been rendered by a court of competent jurisdiction, it is conclusive as to all rights, questions, or facts directly involved and actually, or by necessary implication, determined therein, whether the court was correct at the time or not. We apply four factors to determine whether the doctrine of res judicata bars this appeal. One, whether the issue decided in the former adjudication is identical with the present issue. Two, whether there was a final judgment on the merits. Three, whether the parties are identical. And four, whether there was a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issues in the prior adjudication." That's Moe at 595. In this adversary proceeding, the first element is dispositive. The cause of action in count one of Byers' state court counterclaim is for recovery on a note. The cause of action in this adversary proceeding is for an alleged violation of the discharge injunction. The two are not identical, and therefore claim preclusion does not apply. Before we move on to collateral estoppel or issue preclusion, we first need to address debtor's claim that the bankruptcy court has exclusive jurisdiction to determine whether the debt they allegedly owe buyers is accepted from the general discharge they were granted in their Chapter 7 case. Debtors did not cite any direct authority for this proposition, but it is, in any event, contrary to Eighth Circuit law. In Apex Oil Company, Inc. v. Sparks, 406 F3rd, 538, 542-43, 8th Circuit, 2005, the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the denial of a debtor's motion to reopen a closed bankruptcy case to determine whether certain debts had been discharged. Because the matter was already being heard in state court, the state court had concurrent jurisdiction over the matter, and the state court was fully competent to decide whether the debts had in fact been discharged. Despite the court's use of the word dischargeability in its discussion, the case did not involve or implicate an exception to discharge under 11 U.S.C. Section 523. It involved the debtor's general discharge under Section 11 U.S.C. Section 1141D1, which is identical in all relevant aspects to the general discharge provided in 11 U.S.C. Section 727B. Thus, while bankruptcy courts have exclusive jurisdiction to determine and enter orders granting discharges, state courts have concurrent jurisdiction thereafter to determine whether a particular debt has been discharged. In this adversary proceeding, the state court therefore had and has concurrent jurisdiction and was and is fully competent to decide whether the debt or debts in question were discharged in debtor's Chapter 7 case. Turning then to issue preclusion, in SDDS Inc. v. State, 569 Northwest 2nd, 289, South Dakota, 1997, the South Dakota Supreme Court explained, and I quote, "The following four tests must be met to sustain collateral estoppel. One, the issue decided in the prior adjudication was identical with the one presented in the action in question. Two, there was a final judgment on the merits. Three, the party against whom the plea is asserted was a party or in privity with a party to the prior adjudication. And four, the party against whom the plea is asserted had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue in the prior adjudication." That's SDDS Inc. at 293-94. In this adversary proceeding, the record demonstrates that Byers has established elements 1, 3, and 4. The relevant issue in both the state court action and this adversary proceeding is whether the debt described in count 1 of Byers' state court counterclaim was discharged in bankruptcy. Debtors were and are plaintiffs in the state court action, and debtors had a full and fair opportunity through their objection to Byers' motion for summary judgment to litigate the issue in the state court action. At first blush, the second element presents a problem for Byers. The state court's letter decision is clearly not a final judgment, at least as that term is used to determine whether an appeal may be taken from a decision. However, in Seamer v. Nangle, 275 F3rd 481, 8th Circuit 2001, the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals drew a distinction between a final judgment for purposes of appeal and a final judgment for purposes of issue preclusion. Quote, "We believe that the contempt order is a final judgment for collateral estoppel purposes. The bankruptcy appellate panel held otherwise because it concluded that under the relevant state law, a civil contempt order is not final until it has been enforced. Although that is true for the purposes of an appeal, recent decisions have relaxed traditional views of the finality requirement in the collateral estoppel context by applying the doctrine to matters resolved by preliminary rulings or to determinations of liability that have not yet been completed by an award of damages or other relief, let alone enforced. According to the restatement second of judgments, moreover, execution or enforcement are not prerequisites for meeting the finality standard for claim preclusion, and by implication, the finality standard of collateral estoppel as well. For the purposes of collateral estoppel, a judgment must simply be sufficiently firm to be accorded conclusive effect. This may mean little more than that the litigation of a particular issue has reached such a stage that a court sees no really good reason for permitting it to be litigated again. We believe that the Missouri State Court's determination that Mr. Nangle acted willfully and maliciously is a sufficiently final say on the matter to allow it an estoppel effect, and that relitigating it would create the kind of needless duplication of effort and expense that collateral estoppel seeks to prevent. Both Ms. Seamer and Mr. Nangle were fully heard in the Missouri State Court proceeding. The court filed a reasoned opinion, and it gave no indication that its judgment was tentative or likely to be changed. While its judgment may not be subject to appeal, which is one of the considerations relevant to determine whether a judgment is final for collateral estoppel purposes, that in itself is not enough to deny it preclusive effect. We therefore conclude that the contempt order was final for the purposes of collateral estoppel. That's Nangle at 484 to 85. The same analysis leads me to conclude the state court's letter decision is a final judgment for the purposes of issue preclusion. Debtors were fully heard in the state court proceeding, the state court filed a reasoned opinion, and the state court gave no indication that its judgment was tentative or likely to be changed. Therefore, while the state court's letter decision may not be subject to appeal, it is a final judgment for the purposes of issue preclusion. That means I am bound by the state court's decision that the debt described in count one of Byers' state court counterclaim was not discharged in bankruptcy. And that means Byers' efforts to collect that debt cannot and do not violate the discharge injunction. It also means the post-discharge note, which it bears mentioning was executed in favor of Ipswich State Bank, not Byers, cannot and does not constitute an unenforceable reaffirmation agreement. And the reason for that is that under 11 U.S.C. section 524C, both as it read when debtor's case, Chapter 7 case was filed and as it now reads, a reaffirmation agreement necessarily involves a prepetition debt that would otherwise be discharged. Consequently, to the extent it relates to count one of Byers' state court counterclaim, debtor's adversary complaint no longer states a claim upon which relief can be granted. With respect to the debts described in counts 3 and 4 of Byers' state court counterclaim, the analysis is much simpler. In both counts, Byers states unambiguously, quote, Byers is requesting judgment against Brad and Brenda Stabler only for those amounts determined not to be discharged in their prior Chapter 7 bankruptcy, end quote. Debtors have offered no reasonable interpretation of this statement that would permit me to conclude Byers is in any way attempting to collect, recover, or offset a debt discharged in debtor's bankruptcy. If Byers recovers everything he has requested in counts 3 and 4 of his state court complaint, he will necessarily recover only those amounts determined not to be discharged in debtor's bankruptcy. And Byers' efforts to collect only those amounts cannot and do not violate the discharge injunction. And as was the case with respect to the post-discharge note described in count one of Byers' state court counterclaim, the post-discharge notes in counts three and four of Byers' state court counterclaim, which it bears mentioning were executed in favor of the surers, not Byers, cannot and do not constitute an unenforceable reaffirmation agreement. Because, as I indicated earlier, a reaffirmation agreement necessarily involves a prepetition debt that would otherwise be discharged. Consequently, to the extent it relates to counts 3 and 4 of Byers' state court counterclaim, debtor's adversary complaint fails to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. While that effectively disposes of debtor's adversary complaint, Byers has also asked the court to abstain from hearing this matter pursuant to 28 U.S.C. section 1334C1. In N. Ray Williams 256 BR 885 893-94, BAP 8th Circuit 2001, the 8th Circuit Bankruptcy Appellate Panel explained, because the statute provides only general standards for determining whether abstention is appropriate, i.e., in the interest of justice or comity, and I keep saying comity, it's C-O-M-I-T-Y for those not familiar with the concept, it's not comedy, Courts have been guided by well-developed notions of judicial abstention, which include the premise that federal courts should exercise their jurisdiction if it is properly conferred, and that abstention is the exception rather than the rule. That's Williams at 893-94. The bankruptcy panel listed 12 factors a court should consider in determining whether abstention is appropriate. 1. The effect or lack thereof on the efficient administration of the estate if a court recommends abstention. 2. The extent to which state law issues predominate over bankruptcy issues. 3. The difficult or unsettled nature of the applicable law. 4. The presence of a related proceeding commenced in state court or other non-bankruptcy court. 5. The jurisdictional basis, if any, other than 28 U.S.C. section 1334. The 6th, the degree of relatedness or remoteness of the proceeding to the main bankruptcy case. 7. The substance rather than the form of an asserted core proceeding. 8. The feasibility of severing state law claims from core bankruptcy matters to allow judgments to be entered in state court with enforcement left to the bankruptcy court. 9. The burden on the bankruptcy court's docket. 10. The likelihood that the commencement of the proceeding involves forum shopping by one of the parties. 11. The existence of a right to a jury trial. And 12. The presence in the proceeding of non-debtor parties. That's Williams at 894. One of the cases the bankruptcy appellate panel cited was Matter of Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific Railroad Co., 6F 3rd 1184, 7th Circuit 1993. In which the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals stated, quote, courts should apply these factors flexibly, for their relevance and importance will vary with the particular circumstances of each case, and no one factor is necessarily determinative. That's Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific Railroad Co. at 1189. In this adversary proceeding, the majority of the Williams factors support abstention. With respect to the first factor, debtor's Chapter 7 case was fully administered and closed almost 6 years ago. Abstention would thus have no effect on the efficient administration of debtor's estate. With respect to the second factor, the specific issue before the court in this adversary proceeding is whether Byers has violated the discharge injunction and should therefore be sanctioned. That is clearly a matter of federal bankruptcy law. However, pursuant to 11 U.S.C. Section 524A, a discharge only operates as an injunction against attempts to collect, recover, or offset a debt that has been discharged. And pursuant to 11 U.S.C. Section 727B, only pre-petition debts are discharged. On their face, the transactions about which debtors have complained occurred post-petition and would thus not be subject to the discharge injunction. Debtors argue those transactions were fraudulent, which, if true, would present a problem for Byers. However, in this context, whether Byers acted fraudulently would be determined by state law, and that issue would clearly predominate. With respect to the fourth factor, debtors have commenced a related proceeding in state court. Moreover, that state court action has been pending for more than 2 years. It's a little late in the day for the bankruptcy court to step in. With respect to the eighth factor, I believe it would be possible, even preferable, to sever debtor state court claims, allow the state court to determine, as it already has with respect to count one of Byers' state court counterclaim, whether any of the debts Byers is seeking to collect have been discharged. And if the state court determines, albeit contrary to the express language of counts 3 and 4 of Byers' state court counterclaim, any of those debts have been discharged, allow debtors to renew their complaint. That is not an ideal solution, but it's better than having the parties battling, and I use that word advisedly, simultaneously on two fronts. And it's better than having two courts racing to decide whether Byers acted fraudulently. With respect to the 10th factor, I also firmly believe debtors are engaging in forum shopping. They filed their action in state court. They raised the issue of their discharge in their state court complaint. They allowed their action to proceed in state court for some 19 months. And they waited to commence this adversary proceeding until the state court ruled against them on one matter and appear poised to rule against them on another. Nothing in the record leads me to believe we would be here today if the state court had ruled in debtor's favor. And I cannot and will not condone their blatant attempt to circumvent the decision of the state court in which they chose to proceed more than 2 years ago and secure a different or better result in this court. With respect to the 11th factor, debtors have demanded a trial by jury in the state court action. And the state court is far better equipped to honor debtors' demand than I am. Finally, with respect to the 12th factor, while debtors have not named them as defendants in this adversary proceeding, several other parties are involved in debtor state court action, including First State Bank of Roscoe, Arnold Schur, Schur Farms, Inc., Roger Ernst, United Bankers Bank, and Ipswich State Bank. Many of those parties were involved in the transactions giving rise to the claims described in counts 1, 3, and 4 of Byers State Court counterclaim. This would seem to implicate them to one degree or another in the allegedly fraudulent conduct about which debtors have complained. Under the circumstances, the state court is in a better position to afford full, or more nearly full, relief in this matter. The remaining factors are for the most part neutral, or perhaps tip the scale slightly against abstention. However, none of them, alone or together, is sufficient to outweigh the factors I have discussed. As an alternative grounds for dismissing debtor's complaint, I will therefore abstain from hearing this matter pursuant to 28 U.S.C. section 1334(c)(1). The court will enter an order granting Byers' motion to dismiss, and that will moot both debtor's application for a temporary injunction and its motion for summary judgment. Court's adjourned.